In the conversation you're about to hear, Campbell elaborates on a few of his favorite subjects, such as the relevance or irrelevance of Eastern-style gurus for Western seekers, and the underlying tension between Eastern spiritual wisdom and what he saw as the authentic Western spirit, namely, truth attained through the individual's own path. Campbell also offers us an intimate look at his relationship with famed psychologist Carl Jung and Heinrich Zimmer, who also exerted a tremendous influence on him. And we'll hear his thoughts on humanity's modern relationship with the natural world and the role of myth in restoring that relationship. This conversation took place in the spring of 1979, when Joseph was 75 years old. We enter the conversation speaking about the dualities at work in human life.
My stepson happens to be taking a world history class, and his group was studying Peru. I kind of got an opportunity to recover my own interest in Peruvian South America culture and so forth, and just again looked at the devastation that the Spaniards wrought when they came to America, destroying these cultures, the Aztecs, the Incas, the Mayans. Mm. And there was a scene that is related where the friar that had accompanied Pizarro on his expedition showed Atahualpa the Bible. This is God. And Atahualpa couldn't deal with it. It wasn't that, how could God be in this material object? It was so beautiful, the message that was there. And I guess the reason I brought that up is just the nature of conflict perhaps is related to that inability to go beyond the mind, that to recognize the connection that we all have. And somehow we get in the way of that by saying, this is mine and that's not yours.
That's right. But then the opposite problem comes up when one becomes too strongly linked to the commonality and losing touch with one's own individuality. Because part of our loyalty to life is being loyal to our own lives, you know, not sacrificing oneself, but letting oneself play in relation to the other in a prudent and positive way.
Striking the balance, as the Buddha said, the middle path.
Well, yes, and there's a little verse from the Rig Veda that I'm very much attached to, of the tree of life and two birds on the tree, fast friends. One eats the fruit of the tree, and the other, not eating, watches. And those are two aspects of ourselves. And one, we eat the fruit of the tree. We kill a life in order to eat it. And we win, and we play the world of action. But then in contemplation, you see, as the meditative one, we are removed from the destiny of the one who is killing and winning and losing. I think of a tennis match where on the court one is on one side of the net, and there wouldn't be a game if one didn't play that game hard, you know, against the other one. But also there is the referee who doesn't care who wins. And a good sport is one who can hold both positions. You're playing the game as hard as you can, but you're a good loser. Do you see what I mean?
Sure.
And it's those two positions, the general one that looks at the duality of the field. You mustn't say that should not be, because if it wasn't there, there wouldn't be any life. And yet you participate on one side. That's part of participating in life. That's part of the participation in the sorrows of life, the cruelties of life and all that. There's a Buddhist formula for the bodhisattva, for the one who has illumination but determines to remain in the world. All life is sorrowful. So the bodhisattva participates with joy in the sorrows of the world, suffering himself in the world. This is the crucified one who came to be crucified. You know, the crucifixion, it's not something that should not have happened. That's something that must happen. The participation in the sorrows. It's an important concept.
Part of life.
Yeah.
Joseph, I want to publicly acknowledge you for editing this marvelous book called The Portable Jung. It's an incredible selection of the works of Jung, and I think anyone could pick it up and get a fairly good idea of where Jung was coming from. And it gives me an opportunity to ask you I know that Jung has had an effect on your own work and your own life, and I'd like to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first interest in the world that I'm interested in was in mythology. It grabbed me when I was very young, and one mythology after another took over. And when I was a student then, a graduate student in Germany, back in 28, 29, I discovered for myself the works of Freud and Jung. And this opened up a psychological dimension in a field that I had no knowledge of in those terms. And suddenly I realized why the subject was interesting to me, and a lot of new mysteries and wonders came through. Now, Jung was not known very well in the United States at that time. I think there were two small translations of works that he had published. Freud was well known, only I had not been a student of psychology and didn't know Freud. So both of these men began to talk to me, you might say, and inform me about one aspect of my own subject. I now realize that one aspect of the subject is the psychological mystery, and the other aspect is the historical and ethnographical side of the show. So on the psychological side, these two men played back and forth in my thinking. When I did The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which was back in the 40s, middle and early 40s, they were a sort of equal in my thinking, and Freud served in one context and Jung in another aspect of my interpretation of myths. But then the years following that book, Jung became more and more eloquent to me. I think the longer you live, the more Jung can say to you. And I go back to him, and things that I've read are saying new things. Freud never says a new thing to me anymore. It always comes out, you know, Oedipus and a few things like that. And I got bored with that. And my feeling is that Freud tells us what myths mean to neurotics. And Jung gives us a clue to how to let the myth talk to us in its own terms without putting a formula on it. And so I've been with Jung, you might say, for, well, now since 1928. That's a long, long spell.
Yeah.
And as I say, he means more and more and more to me. Now, for me, he's not the final word at all. I don't think there is a final word. But he has opened me up to prospects and vistas that are of his work. Now, there's one other thing. In my life came Heinrich Zimmer, who was a great Indologist and a genius with respect to the interpretation of symbols. And he is, in my mind, supplementary to Jung. They were close friends for the last years of Zimmer's life. In fact, Jung edited Zimmer's German of Posthuma, as I edited Zimmer's English. So when I met Jung, we were, you know, co-editors. Zimmer was kind of nice. And so those two men are the ones that talked to me.
You had personal interaction with Carl Jung. What was he like as a person?
Oh, this was a magnificent man. And he was no Herr Doktor professor. He was playing it all the time. And we did not talk about subjects in which he was an authority, you know. We were ad-libbing rather a fresh conversation. It was just a tea that my wife and I had with Dr. Jung and Mrs. Jung at Bollingen, which is his place on the lake of Zurich, at the other end of the lake from Zurich itself, that marvelous little castle he built with his own hands, you know, that stone thing on the lake. We were greeted when we arrived and sat there by the lake in genial, easy conversation. He was a big, magnificent man. And my wife tells me that his eyes were very attractive. That was fun.
Yeah. Have you, in your own studies of mythology, verified any of, like, the collective unconscious is one thing that, have you found that to be a motif throughout mythology?
What are you going to do with the fact that the same motifs appear everywhere? They do. There's a constellation of motifs, basic motifs in mythology, that are fundamental. How do you explain it? It's come from the same zone as dreams. So the individual dreams and your dream won't be like mine, let's say. But here we come to a level of what might be called racial dreams, the myths. And they match, they match, they match. And the word collective unconscious, or you might say general unconscious, is a term just to recognize that fact and that there is a common humanity built into our nervous system out of which our imagination works. The appeal of these constants is very deep, generally human. Now, the explanation that is often given in the Freudian circles of individual experiences, you know, being the source of dream, biography, not biology,